And it hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
He saw a classic flying saucer, really, standing in a clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and he said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, and welcome to the show. This is Martin Willis, your host, and we have a great one for you this evening. A lot of people are excited about my guest. I've gotten a lot of email. It's Diana Pasulka. And she's a professor of religious studies. I'll go into more of that as the time draw nears when she's coming aboard. But right now, in just a minute, we have Alejandro Rojas joining us for UFO updates. And I do want to tell you, next week we are going to have a new phone number, and that's through the KGRA radio. It's their paranormal radio app hotline. And so make sure you add this number to your mobile phones. It's actually 85KGRA-live, or the real number is 855-472-5483, and these are going to be screen calls. It's all going to start next week, and we will queue, of course, when the calls are welcome, which is generally, I usually take calls in the second hour of the show. I want to thank everyone that supports the show. Anyone can do that. All you have to do is go over to podcastufo.com, and the information's over there. And speaking of information, our blog this week is UFOs and the science that the scientists that love them. And so that's a blog by Charles Lear, another great blog. We have weekly blogs at this point by Charles, does a nice job. And so I think that is going to get us started. Alejandro, how are you doing today?
Hello, I am doing good. Busy on UFO Day.
Yeah. Is it UFO Day? I didn't know that.
It is, yeah, and I guess it commemorates the Kenneth Arnold sighting, and I even had the local NBC network was in interviewing myself and Karen about World UFO Day, so that's going to air in like an hour.
Now, how come I do a UFO show and I had no clue? That's just embarrassing. I can't believe it.
That is embarrassing.
Yeah. Wow.
You should be reprimanded by the UFO Ufologist Council.
Yeah, I know. That. Wow. Yeah, I think I just lost some ground. Oh, well. Yeah, awesome. Well, fun. And so what else is happening?
I know, and my social media even has some goofy pictures around UFO Day. But, yeah, a lot is going on. So our good buddy MJ Banias, and this is really cool, he's been getting articles in Vice about UFOs. And that's so cool that he's been able to do that. And his latest is called Meet Silicon Valley's UFO Hunters. In fact, I think he even references your guest tonight in that story.
That's right.
Diana Pasulka, because in her book she was working with a Silicon Valley kind of startup, or not even startup, I think he's a venture capitalist. I'm sure she'll clear it all up, but about UFOs. And so he's kind of talking about how there are these startups and there are others that are into the topic, which is pretty interesting that you know, people in Silicon Valley would have that interest. So it's a great article. And it ties into some other articles. In fact, there was another article by Tyler Rogaway, who we've also interviewed from the War Zone. He was examining these Navy patents. And you may ask, well, what does that have to do with UFOs and everything? Well, they're advanced theoretical physics, these patents. And what's interesting about them is Hal Puthoff, who is one of the guys who works with ATIP, with Lou Elizondo's Pentagon project. In fact, Hal Puthoff has worked with Robert Bigelow for many years. And so they were contracted to work, and some of these papers are, theoretical physics papers, are in the ATIP documents that we've seen. So that's where his root is. In fact, it's very interesting. Hal Puthoff has been working on paranormal topics with the government for decades. In fact, he was instrumental in the remote viewing project, where it was kind of a psychic project that the government had started up. He was working with Stanford and the CIA at the beginning to develop this kind of psychic ability called remote viewing. And that program went on for decades. Many suspect it still goes on. So Hal Putoff's been around for a long time, and he's referenced in these documents, and that's kind of the tie-in with ATIP here. But what's interesting about these documents is that many feel it's kind of pseudoscience. It's so theoretical. It's not provable. It's beyond the, you know, our capabilities completely. And so what he's kind of saying here is that although the patent office said, no, you know, these are just too out there. They're not even, you can't even demonstrate these technologies. But the government came back because these were submitted by a government, a Navy physicist. And they said, well, actually, we're working on testing some of this stuff. It is legit. And we believe the Chinese are working on it. So they approved the patents to be reviewed. And they're in the review process now. And so they were also made public. So it's just kind of a weird story, especially because it's kind of not really stuff that can be worked on. Well, another guy who's on social media quite a bit lately, Deep Prasad, he actually wrote a Medium article on this and kind of boiled it down some more, which is helpful. And he kind of said the same thing. It's ridiculous the patent office is even looking at these things because they're really far out there. But he gave a little more context to it. So some of you may have heard Michio Kaku talk about UFOs and ETs, and he often references, I think it's called Kardashev, it's a K scale, they call it, where they call civilizations by the amount of energy they can manipulate, essentially. A type 1 can manipulate or harness the energy of a sun. We're not even close to a type 1. We're below that. But that, like Deep mentions in this article, that it would take a type 2 civilization or more to be able to harness a technology that is theorized in these papers. And some of the papers, at least one of them, even has the science a little messed up. So he's wondering, you know, why are we even looking at this right now? His thing is kind of like, he suspects the reason why the Navy is putting out these patents, and this ties into Hal Putoff and ATIP, it's because they think this is the sort of technology that they're observing with these UFOs, like in the Nimitz incident, or for those of you who have been watching Unidentified, you know, last week they reviewed the Roosevelt case where these other jet fighters encountered these objects that were like cubes inside of translucent orbs. And so he's saying that the media and science really needs to make note and take serious attention, because if the Navy is serious that they believe, you know, there are these advanced technologies beyond our abilities that are being observed, that this demonstrates that this is a big deal to the Navy and to the government. And so it should be a big deal to the general public and to the scientific community. He's essentially saying that, you know, that it demonstrates that the technology exists and is being observed. So scientists in particular should be interested in understanding the science behind them and trying to figure out what they are and who they are. And so some really interesting stuff. He kind of talks about his motivation for being all of this is kind of similar to mine. It's similar to something Commander David Fravor said. He's the guy who chased, you know, that UFO in the Nimitz event. He said, I don't know whose they are, but I would like to fly one because, yeah, that's, you know, right, they demonstrate, yeah, this amazing technology. And it's kind of the same thing. I got involved with this, and one of the things that really gets me, I started off in school wanting to be a rocket scientist, is the idea of being able to fly around and to check out the universe and go explore like Star Trek or something. So, you know, it's exciting to him, and he feels it should be exciting to others that these devices or these aircraft seem to exist, and somebody's flying them around.
It's almost like they're trying to reverse engineer from observation.
Exactly. That's exactly what they're doing. And that's what Bigelow has talked about doing in the past. You know, the MUFON symposium is coming up, and one of the speakers is going to be John Schussler, who is a mentor of mine. He worked at NASA. That's exactly what inspired him. Same with Bob Wood, who was an engineer, aerospace engineer, who's also a board member with MUFON. So a lot of scientists have been inspired and you know, kind of thinking, well, maybe if all we can do is see these things, and observe them. Maybe there is some technology that can be gleaned from the observations. And many scientists think that's ridiculous. There's no way you can glean any science from just observations. Others disagree, such as Hal Puthoff or others who believe that they are being able to observe some of this technology in use. And To the Stars, in fact, is very serious about the potential of being able to develop some of these technologies that are being observed.
Yeah. It's almost like anything really amazing, you know, starts with an idea and then, you know, they figure out how to do whatever it is. It's just along those lines. And that's
what science is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
it's observing a phenomena and then trying to understand how that phenomena works.
Yeah. And duplicate it. Yeah. Very interesting. Anything else happening?
Let's see. There are tons of headlines. It's an exciting time because the media is taking UFOs so seriously. Mm-hmm. There are just a ton of headlines out there. So there are interviews. A new interview with Chris Mellon is out there.
That's right.
This is a really interesting survey that was done by Rasmussen, I believe is the name of the company. And there's not a lot of outlets that have picked it up. But essentially, they're a survey company, and they did a survey about people's beliefs regarding UFOs. Is it likely there's life on other planets and that sort of thing? Most people said were kind of hesitant. Now, one of the sites that broke this down is kind of a political group, so they kind of broke down. They found there wasn't much of a difference between political parties.
But interesting.
Men were more likely than women to say it was very likely that there's intelligent life on other planets, to the tune of men at 39% and women at 24%. So I found that kind of interesting. But as far as posing a threat to national security, 61% said no, 12% said yes, and 27% unsure. I think that's important because the nature of what we're hearing with these government programs is that, you know, they're seen as a threat. But it seems like the general public has not bought on to that idea. However, it's not necessarily that, ATIP or Lou Elizondo is saying that these are definitively a threat. By the very nature of them being in our airspace without us knowing who they are, that's what makes them a threat, not necessarily their motivations. We have to learn to be able to confirm whether or not they are. However, governments such as Chile, who has CEFA-A, which is a government-ran UFO research organization, they've actually had meetings with high-level officials to determine whether or not this phenomenon is a threat. And they've determined no, because they've seen so many encounters, including some similar to the Nimitz encounter, where jets are scrambled, there's kind of a cat and mouse, and then the unknown object flies off, that they haven't shown any overt sort of aggressive behavior. And so they do not feel that they are necessarily a threat. And I would say that just our own government hasn't necessarily gotten there, at least as far as we know, in assessing the motivations or the potential for a threat. But because they can label it a threat, that allows them to have these government programs and to get government funding. So it's sort of a semantics thing as well. But it is sort of interesting that right now, although this topic is becoming more popular, that the public by far does not consider the phenomena a threat. And that's probably a good thing, because I think the public would feel much more uncomfortable with the whole idea if they did perceive it as a threat.
That is so true. Yeah, it makes total sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a really interesting survey out there.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, that's really something about the difference between men and women. And their beliefs. It's probably because women know that, us men aren't that intelligent and they don't have much help, much hope for finding more out there.
We're more intelligent species.
Yeah, that's true.
Could be very well.
Could be. Alejandro, thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem. We'll have to get, you'll have to ask Diane what her perception is of all of that. But thank you very much. Of course, you can see all of this at openminds.tv right there on the front page.
That's right. All right. I'll talk to you next week. You take care. Thank you.
All right.
All right. All right. Our guest of this evening, I'm very glad to welcome Diana Pasulka, and she is a professor of religious studies at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington, and a chair of the Department of Philosophy and Religion And her research focuses on religion and technology. I think that's fascinating, including the supernatural belief and its connections to the digital technologies and environment. Very exciting. So welcome to the show, Diana.
Thanks. Can I go ahead and click myself in?
Okay. Yes, do that, please. Yes.
Okay, great.
All right. Yes. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. So can you tell the listening audience a little bit about yourself and how, with your background, how you got into this whole thing you've been studying?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in California, and I went to undergraduate and graduate during the dot-com boom in the early 90s and late 90s, pretty much. You know, you spend a lot of time when you get a PhD in school. And what I did was a lot of people have misconceptions about religion. And so first off, I want to tell the audience that in the field of religious studies, what we do is I'm not a minister. We don't promote religion. We actually study it. So we study the effects of religion. In fact, someone like Jacques Vallée, when he spoke to the UN in the 1970s, he basically said, it doesn't matter, you know, whether or not UFOs or the phenomenon actually exists, belief in it exists and it is at an all-time high. So the reality, the objective reality is beside the point. So in religious studies, that's kind of our track. That's what we do. We study how people believe practices, how it affects society, how it emerges from different types of environments in society. And so what I did was I'm a Catholic historian, basically by training, and I looked at various kinds of things. I was always interested in technology, of course, because I was within the environment of Silicon Valley. I mean, I went to school California research universities right in the heart of Silicon Valley, and then I did get my PhD at Syracuse University, and so here I am in the South. And so how did I get into studying UFOs? I've actually never seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I wasn't really interested in UFOs. And what happened was that I was on a normal track of being a professor and looking at the historical tradition of Christianity and Catholicism. And I did a book on the doctrine of purgatory, which for your listeners, if they don't know, is this doctrine of where souls go after they die. Catholics believe in this kind of intermediate place where if you're not good enough to get into heaven, you stay in this place and, you know, get better. Your soul gets better and then gets into heaven. And I found out that, it took me 10 years to write this book. So, wow. Yeah, sometimes you have to do a lot of work to do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I found, you know, your research in the best of worlds should surprise you. You should be surprised by your research, and I sure was. So I found that purgatory started out as a place, as places, and there's still a purgatory cave in Ireland on this lake called Loch Derg. And people would go there in the 1200s and 1300s. And purgatory then eventually became a dogma of the Catholic Church. And people would go there and they would do, yeah. So, you know, so you can see then how religions really emerge from environments. So I wanted to really show how there was this new type of religiosity that emerged from our techno environment, our new digital infrastructure, which we are now in, and we have no clue really, you know, how it's going to play out for us. But I could tell that the belief systems of the people around me were focused on non-human intelligences and UFOs and things like that, you know, in Silicon Valley. And I also, in my research on purgatory, I came across a lot of aerial phenomena. And I started to read the work of Jacques Vallée, Passport to Magonia, read very much like my own purgatory book, in the sense that he was focusing on historical incidences of aerial phenomena. And I honestly didn't know what I was looking at the time. So I just made a log and a list of this phenomena. And I showed it to a friend of mine, and the friend looked at it and said, well, this looks like UFOs, looks like a Spielberg film. And I thought it was crazy at the time, you know, and I said, oh, you know, I kind of said, no. But there happened to be synchronistically a UFO conference in the town where I live, and I attended it, and I heard Chris Bledsoe.
Oh, yeah.
He made, yeah, so mm-hmm. he lives near me, actually. And so I realized that this phenomena, the aerial phenomena, was still around. And then I did all the preliminary research on it and thought that I would go into this very easy study of a comparison between ancient aerial phenomena and contemporary aerial phenomena. And I had no clue. I was totally naive. And I got into something that, in a sense, became something way over my head. At many points, I decided I was going to stop doing the research because it was just too weird for me. I came across the scientists, right, that you and Alejandro were talking about. And I decided that if I were going to do a book on this, that the new study would be to study them. And so I decided to immerse myself within their communities. And Jacques Vallée became a friend, introduced me to many of them. I met many myself. I found out that there was a long standing study that had been going on in the area in which I had lived from as a child, of people who had had experiences. And I have a brother who's a special forces, and I also another brother who is now a captain of the police force in I won't say where, but in California. He doesn't want to, he doesn't want me to out him. But so, you know, I mean, so there were lots of phenomena, let's just put it that way, within the place where I had grown up. And I hadn't actually thought about it as UFO phenomena until 2011 and 2012. And that's really how I started my book. And I, instead of studying the experiencers, the people who actually do the, you know, I studied the people who were the scientific experiencers, and I call them the meta experiencers. And in many ways, they were what Jacques Vallée had termed and Hynek had termed the invisible college. But they're not the invisible college anymore. They're more like Fight Club, right? They're more like, we don't mm-hmm. talk about this. So I was lucky to be involved in this group for many years, and the book emerged directly from the being, what's called ethnography, right? You kind of immersing yourself within these communities. And I just took a lot of notes and did what I did. I just kind of documented what I thought was a new type of religiosity, is what we call it in my field.
Uh-huh. Wow, this is really fascinating. We got to go into a break in just 2 minutes or so. But sure. There's also a lot of parallels in the belief systems too, isn't there? Between, you know, a lot of things created in religions. I'm just guessing because I don't have, you know, the education that you have by any means. But I mean, it seems like when there's a lot of unexplained things, like a religion would explain it in their magical or the work of God or whatever it is. Is there parallels along the lines of UFOs and creating religions being initiated?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, this is basically the creation. I mean, what we're looking at is the documentation of a new form of religion that's emerging from the technology within which we live. We can't get off the grid. So we're inundated with, you know, frequencies, radiation, you know, all kinds of things that come directly from the black mirror, the screen of our phones and computers and, you know, technologies. So I'm being aware that you need to go to break. But that's a question that I could ask, that I could answer more fully if you'd like.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. So why don't we hop into the break now? All right. So hang in, everyone. We'll be right back right after this break. You said that you grew up in California, so I thought we would talk a little bit off topic during this break. In Southern California, you grew up and no, I'm sorry.
No, I grew up in. Do you know where Folsom Lake is?
Folsom Lake.
It's in Northern California, and it's right below Tahoe.
Oh, really? Because I lived in South Lake Tahoe. I should know where it is, but
really?
I don't.
Yes.
And so there are a lot of things going on there.
Yeah, there's a study that's ongoing since I think the 70s or 80s of people who have had experiences there. Yes.
Wow. And what type? Are we talking about, you know, just UFO sightings or more than that?
No, unfortunately, we're talking about more than that. We're talking about people who have had direct C3, I guess, type episodes, and sometimes being injured, and sometimes wow. surviving their injuries. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And are these a lot of times, I'm sure, since you've looked at, you know, this topic quite a bit, you know that a lot of people have repeat experiences of
yes,
things going on.
They've had repeat experiences. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it seems like that's a very hot region that people don't know about, and maybe for purposefully, intentionally, they don't know about it.
Yeah. So is this actually part of the Sierra?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. That's so beautiful there.
I love it. Yeah. I miss it.
Yeah, I bet you do. but it's funny. I've never really, you know, I actually was, I had moved out of Lake Tahoe when I had my UFO experience. And so I didn't really pay attention to the topic when I was there, you know, if things were actually happening in that region. But I know, you know, of course, California is, you know, is the top UFO sightings in the country, of course. You know, a lot of it has to do with population and sure. the good weather as well.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. You can see a lot.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. All right, we got 1 minute left to this break. And so as far as the area there, are there also like sightings that you know of, like that people actually see the craft or lights or...
Yes, know? Yes. They see kind of like the plasma craft.
Oh, like the orbs or whatever?
Yeah, but much larger than they generally are. You know, they look like crafts, but they look like plasma crafts, kind of orange colored.
Yeah, yeah. There was someone doing research through MUFON that, and he was just focusing on the orange, you know, he called them orange orbs, but, you know, but that was his total focus. He was on the
wow.
show at one time. So, yeah. And anything else, or is it basically they're seeing more or less the same type of thing there?
No, I could tell you more, but I can't actually say.
You can't what?
I can't actually say
yeah,
what more there is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, I do know that I was trying to think of where it was where yeah, I think it was the Marin County. There's someone I've been in touch with out there. That's the area that I lived in when I was, for the most part, of the 9 years that I lived out there. But I'm
beautiful.
In touch with someone now that they're saying there's still a lot of activity going all the way up to, you know, all the way north to the Oregon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So really something else.
Here we go.
All right. Welcome back. My guest tonight is Diana Posolka. And just before we went into break, we were talking about meta experiencers. And you were talking about Jacques Vallée. And very interesting. You actually got to know him. He is, I'm sure you know, he's an iconic person when it comes to this topic in general.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. He's iconic in general.
Yeah, that's right. He is. He is in many ways. Yes.
Yeah.
And my friend Lee Spiegel's show is going live. I believe it's, I want to say it's August 1st or August 4th. Let me just take a look at the calendar. And that's going to be his first guest on the show.
That's great. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, he's and I believe it is August 1st. He's going to be coming up, Lee Spiegel. So everyone should pay attention to that night. It should be a really great show. Yeah, I did get to meet him. Boy, is he tall.
Yes, he's tall.
Yeah, and very nice. And had a nice, really nice conversation with him. And
yeah.
I like the fact that, you know, his attitude after all these years is, you know, basically we still have no idea, or it could be many things.
Yeah, yeah. I tend to think that it is many things, frankly.
Yeah. And how do you approach that?
Okay, so, I mean, if you think about it, well, first let's get back to your question about how is this kind of like a religion?
Yeah. Oh, yes, right.
If that's all right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay, so basically, we tend to think here in the United States of religions as the kinds of, you know, if it doesn't look like the kinds of religions of which we are familiar, which are the Western types of religions, you know, Christianity or Judaism, they don't have a God, And, you know, we tend to think, well, I don't see the correlation between UFO belief in UFOs and religion. And I always like to respond to that like I do with my students. You know, if you knew, there are thousands of religions, and there many of them, they don't even look like each other. If you took Christian religions, they don't look like each other, okay? Lots of, like Catholicism, when I first got to the South, a lot of my students didn't know that Catholics were Christians. And I had to kind of do a timeline and show, you know, well, actually, you know, so look at Buddhism, like Zen Buddhism. It's basically there's no God, and they want you to get rid of any concept or even religious dogma. So, you know, so religions don't look like each other, but what do they have in common? Well, a lot of things that they have in common is they try to answer the big questions about our place in the universe, our places in the cosmos. And a lot of times what you have in religions are beings from the sky coming down and meeting with humans, like non-human intelligence coming down from the sky, sometimes in a vehicle, sometimes not with wings, sometimes with no wings. And they somehow impart to us wisdom, technology, ways of being, and things like that. So if you take religion in that most very basic form, that's what we're seeing here. It's also mythology, you know, the myth of Prometheus, right? So Prometheus is this immortal, he's not a god, he's like a god person. He's a titan, and he gives humans technology and then gets horribly punished for it, right? So what we're seeing here is we're seeing kind of like this mythology that is now in my, and what surprised me most about what I was doing was that I was actually meeting people who were actually creating this technology. So it wasn't really a myth anymore. And I thought, well, this is the weirdest thing I've ever studied in my life, because, you know, if you look at what I've published, it's all, you can look at it and say, surely that's just, you know, what they thought at the time. But you can't say that now, because we're actually living within the technologies that these people are creating. Now, whether or not their belief system is accurate, that this is non-human intelligence, in fact, is beside the point. The point is that this type of religiosity is effectual. It's creating the types of environment with which we live. So there's this give and take of this religion, not to mention that there are also sightings that we can't identify. And there are also people like the chief of NASA, I think it's Ellis Sofon, but I'm not quite sure. She's still she was a couple years ago. And she comes on the TV and she says, we will find life. We will do it within 20 years. We have the technology to do it. Now, a lot of people, you know, she's not talking about like grays or little green men, or she's talking about like microbes or microbial life or something like that on other planets. But most people don't interpret her as saying that. They interpret her as saying, we are going to find intelligent life. And so there's a bite to this new form of religiosity that's quite different from the old forms of religion of the past. So, you know, so, but I mean, the people that I met various people from different types of sectors of society. I met people who were in programs. I've met people who were academics who had been recruited into programs. And I met academics who were studying just like me. And and what they were studying was of interest to like Hal Puthoff or people like that, you know, people from Bigelow's. You know, he has like a crew of scientists. People from his crew would contact us. And so we were just as interested in them, you know, as they were interested in what we were doing as well. So it was kind of this mutual kind of, what do you know? What do you know kind of thing.
Wow. Do you think that if right now we suddenly had 100% evidence, say, that we have been visited or that we are being visited from another, by another intelligence from another planet outside of the solar system or whatever, do you think that would actually shape religion or change religions?
Yes, that's a really good question. So I have a friend named Jeff Kripal at Rice University, and he's been studying this for a long time. And we differ on this, or at least we differ on this from the last time I talked to him, which is probably about on this topic about 2 months ago. And so he thinks that it would change everything about religions, and religions would undergo a complete I wouldn't say breakdown, but they would be manifestly different. I tend to think that religions have already incorporated the idea of invisible entities and non-human intelligences already. And I know for a fact within the Catholic Church, I've been to the Vatican, I've talked to people there, that many, many people in high up positions in the Vatican absolutely believe in ETs. And that's just a fact. Now, is it a Catholic doctrine? No. Or, you know, will they soon make it one? Probably not. It takes them a long time to make any kind of doctrine. So so I don't think that it's going to impact religions at all. In fact, I think that a lot of people already believe, and I don't think that it's going to, you know, I mean, how it's shaped and what, you know, what we think about it is much more interesting to me, I think, because, you know, a lot of people have these experiences, but like I show in my book, especially say with Ray Hernandez, these experiences get mediated completely and sometimes the very opposite of how these people have experienced them. And that's how they're projected to the population. So a lot of times the population, you know, will go on TV and think that's what an alien looks like or something like that. Well, how would we know what an alien looks like, right? So especially if you get the original person saying, no, that's not really how it was. Case in point, I actually did some interviews with people who had interviewed with John Mack and were mm-hmm. in his book. And so one of the people was Edward Carlos, and he was a professor of art in Tennessee. And so he had to co-author his own chapter with John, for the reason being that John kept calling it an abduction. And Carlos said, it's not an abduction. I feel as if it is an experience. And I feel that it is not, I don't feel abducted in any way. It's not violent. So abduction to him was a very violent term. And he felt that it was, he actually, when I went and talked to him, I spent a whole weekend with his wife and him. And he's an artist. He has really beautiful art. And a lot of it is all inspired by his experiences. Hmm. And so it's really beautiful and expensive. But, you know, I mean, the thing is that his experiences then became abduction experiences because they were in John Mack's book, and John Mack's book then became a New York Times bestseller, and then that created the idea that people have of abduction, right? So, I mean, what I'm trying to also say in my book is that every religion gets mediated that way. Like Christianity is mediated that way. Judaism was mediated that way. So there are people with these experiences. They have these experiences. They tell other people. Other people write them down. A lot of times they write them down and they get it wrong. And then it gets reinterpreted. And then somehow, you know, if you get media involved, like today's media, it, you know, I learned this in The Conjuring. Working as the history consultant on the first Conjuring, what happens is that the actual experience is completely different than what really did happen. And why? Because it sells more if it goes, you know, if you do it this way. If you just do it differently, then, you know, like Ray Hernandez's experience was positive, he felt. However, it was promoted as negative. And that's a big difference.
Wow. Wow. This is really fascinating. And, I'm sure you've heard of the Fatima.
Yes.
And have you done any research into that in particular?
I actually write about it in my book.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That was a fascinating situation. And can you just, in a nutshell, some people out there, there's a lot of new listeners to the show, actually. If you wouldn't mind, just kind of tell the story a little bit in that as much as you can.
Oh, absolutely. So Fatima is, so there are a whole, what I would call, there's a genre of apparitions of the Virgin Mary within the Catholic tradition, and they're called the Blessed Virgin Mary apparitions. And I actually just, somebody, David Metcalf actually just sent me a really cool art piece of the Virgin Mary as an astronaut, and I thought that was really neat. So, but Fatima is, so let me talk about Catholic experiences in general, if I may, only because that's what, you know, that's kind of what I do. Mm-hmm. So I take Fatima in my book, and what I do is I break it. I look at the original sources, and when you look at the original sources of a lot of these, and I think actually the best example of this, and I do this too in the book, is the Teresa of Avila experience of, because a lot of people go to Rome and they've seen this statue of Teresa of Avila, who's this nun, the 16th century nun. And what happens is that there's a statue of her in Rome, and it's a very famous statue by this artist named Bernini. And it shows her, and she's in ecstasy, and it shows a little angel, like a cherubic angel, next to her with a dart, okay? So when I first recognized that the Catholic tradition had a lot of aerial phenomena and strange beings, I started to look at the original sources of these and interpret them from the original languages. And so I looked at, she actually writes about this in her diary, and any one of your listeners can go out and read it for themselves. It's translated well into English, and it's Spanish. And so basically what she says is, she says this. It doesn't look anything, by the way. This is how it gets completely mediated. And the Fatima miracles and almost all the Virgin Mary apparitions follow the same pattern. And this is the pattern. So she has this experience, and she is not necessarily, I hate to say this, not necessarily at the time of a particularly holy person. And she has this experience, and she says, I usually see angels, but they're in my imagination, and they usually look like what I consider to be angels, which are, you know, big beings with wings. But instead, I see a short, shiny thing next to me, and it's actually not in my imagination. It's actually real. It's fleshy, and I can touch it. And instead of touching it, what it does is it takes this what you would call kind of like a dart or something like that, and how would I put it in a nice way? I mean, you know, it examines her bowels, right? And so she's
as nice as you can put it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, and she says that it's a weird, you know, she says that it's at the same time really amazing and really horrible at the same time. Okay, very similar to what you see in, say, Whitley Strieber's, mm-hmm. you know, and also in John Mack's books and things like that. So if you read it, and then you look at the Bernini statue, which is how people encounter that experience of hers, you can see there's a huge difference, right? Mm. And so then you see that the difference, the original source looks much more similar to what we would call today a quote-unquote UFO experience. That does not mean it's a UFO experience. I don't know what it is. I go with Jacques Vallée. I call it the phenomena. It's a phenomena that's odd, and there are patterns that you can see back, you know, hundreds of years ago, and you can still see it today. And so what is that phenomena? Well, that's the question, right? Does it still happen? Yes. Does it get completely mediated through culture so it becomes something completely different? Absolutely. More so than it did before? Probably the same. That's what I would say. Hmm. So the Fatima, you know, if you look at the Fatima miracle, where a lot of people, so, you know, three kids first see something that looks like it's flying along on a cloud or a disc, and it turns out to be what they think is an angel. And it announces to them that they're going to see something in the future. It's going to be this lady, right? And so they never actually call her the Virgin Mary, but this lady comes down, and there's this buzzing sound, and I talk a lot about it because it has a lot of the elements that people talk about today: the buzzing sounds, the inability to, you know, the feeling of not really being, you know, being kind of like underwater, and kind of, you know, everything slows down. And the strange thing about this, though, is that people actually do see. This being announces to the children that it will appear to a lot of people. And so all these people start to come, and
thousands.
Yes, exactly. And it's documented. And you could go online and see this. And you could see the pictures of it. There's an atheist there who writes a commentary on it. And I actually quote him in my book. And he says that I saw the sun. Everybody saw things. Some people saw the same things. And many people saw things that were different. But what was absolutely the case was that it had rained and then everybody was dry. And then they saw what in the Catholic tradition people call the miracle of the sun, where the sun looked like it was a big flying disc falling to the earth. And the Catholic Church took a while to, you know, determine whether or not this was worthy of belief. And they believed that something supernatural did happen. And that's how Fatima was created, this idea of the Virgin Mary and Fatima. But many people, there is a book that's all about this, and it's written in Spanish. And I note it in my book, it's in my bibliography. And Jacques Vallée has written about this, and Jeff Kripal has written about this. So there are people who've written about the Fatima, quote unquote, miracle of the sun and things like that.
So was it actually the Catholic Church that kind of changed it into like more of a religious happening, you know, the Virgin Mary and all that, or was someone else calling or just assuming that it was the Virgin Mary?
Well, you know, that's a really good question. That kind of puts a lot of agency, you know, and kind of, you know, what are we going to call it, right? Are we going to call it the UFO Virgin Mary event? You know, we don't know. You know, I mean, I think what it was that a lot of people found this to be a supernatural event that caused them to, and most of them were Catholic, okay, because that's one of the most Catholic countries in the world. And so, of course, they're going to see it through, you know, they're going to see this as a Catholic miracle. And there's no doubt it was, something that defied normal laws of what people see normally. People who didn't believe saw it. So the Catholic Church deemed it worthy of belief. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean the Catholic Church created the belief? I think that to assign, quote unquote, I mean, that's kind of almost like assigning blame. I think that there isn't really, it's a process, Martin, is what I think it is. It's a process that takes place, and it doesn't necessarily take place intentionally by people. Although with the UFO, with UFO narratives, it certainly does. It certainly has. And I do mention that, like with Project Blue Book, and, you know, a lot of the narrative has been, quote unquote, like Robbie Graham has said, managed. And, you know, that's a managed, we've got here a managed narrative. And what I'm basically saying is that there have been managed narratives in the past of, you know, Christianity is a classic example. So, you know, there's been managed narratives of the early Christian church that a lot of people in my field just take for granted. Bart Ehrman writes a lot about it, you know, how Jesus became, you know, Jesus. I happen to be Catholic, by the way, so, but could very well be excommunicated at any time. I don't think it's going to happen though, because there's a lot of leeway in belief that the Catholic Church allows for, and I think that that's why if it was indisputable that ET is here, that a lot of religions would just accept that.
I think you're right, and also I have mentioned on this show over the last several years, things, you know, little bits of news from the Catholic Church, for instance, that something about that there's possibly intelligent life out there and that we should baptize them or something like that. Did you hear that one?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's been a few other things. And also the observatory and with the canon priests of the astronomers, they're very interested in this whole thing, which is fascinating.
Martin, you know I went there, right?
Oh, no, you did. No, I didn't know you went there. Yeah, no. Yeah. I have not read your book.
You have to read my book before you invite me on your show.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Okay, no, that's okay. So yeah. I end with I know Brother Guy. Brother Guy Consolmagno is the one who wrote the book called Would You Baptize an ET? Okay. And he's a Jesuit monk, right? And an astronomer. And he is now the director of the Vatican Observatory. And so I met him through a friend of mine, Sister Rose, who I work with here. on campus. And so he came here, and I didn't mean to call you out there or anything like that. I was just
I deserve it. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, but I do know a bit about this. So he came out here a couple of years ago, and we were, you know, I said to him, I'm a historian. I want to look through archives. I said, where are all the space, you know, everything that has to do with space and the Catholic history, where is that? Is that at the Vatican Secret Archive? And he said, no, that's actually at the observatory, which is in Castle Gandolfo. And I said, wow. I said, can I come see that sometime? And he said, anytime you want. We have a place there for scholars. You can stay there as long as you want, and I'll give you the keys to the archive, and you know, and, wow, and you can stay there. So I took him up on his offer, and I took a colleague of mine from the space program, the American space program, with me. And so what we did was we went up there and we looked through, you know, original Keplers, and I actually lost one and then found it, and that caused quite a stir. And but we also looked through the, you know, they have a whole wall that's called ET, that's devoted to search for extraterrestrial life. And that was fast. So, of course, I started there. And I went back and looked at everything. And it was really interesting. And this is the most interesting thing that I found. I found this. And this could be a conspiracy in and of itself. So there is a lot of money given by the federal government openly to universities like Harvard and MIT to study this up until about, like, it looks like around the 1980s. Hmm. And then, and this was to look for intelligent life, non-human life out there, right? ET intelligent life. And then it just stops. And then there's this big gap. And then it goes into, like, microbiology type things, right? Like, let's study, you know, things that are not intelligent, but things that are. So I thought that was really interesting. I was like, that's a big gap. And so I just took note of it. I don't know quite what to make of it. But my friend had his own theory, which I won't say, but, you know, what happened in the 1980s. So, you know, is what he would ask me. And so we did. And by the way, you talking about people, you'd like to ride one of these spaceships and look, you know, look at the Earth through the spaceship and everything. Strangely enough, I was there and I was at the Vatican Secret Archive actually to study the case of a Spanish nun who believed that she traveled in space on the wings, quote unquote, of angels over to New Mexico and evangelized the Native Americans there, the indigenous population there. And she traveled and she believed that she saw the earth spinning, and her first book was a cosmography for, she called it, I forgot exactly the name of it, but it was basically a cosmography of the earth from space. Which was kind of interesting, yeah. So talk about the remote viewing thing. So I would call her a proto-remote viewer.
How about that? Isn't that something? We are actually right at break time, so we will jump back and continue our discussion here in just a couple of minutes. So hang in, everyone. This is Martin Willis. My guest tonight is Diana Pasulka, and we'll be back right after these messages. All right, everyone, that's it for the free part of the show. Thank you so much for listening. Next week, we'll be back with Ben Hansen and Walter Bosley. Ben's going to be on for the first half of the show, Walter on for the second half of the show. And if you want to listen to the full shows, all you have to do is support us for $2 or more a month. All that information is on podcastufo.com. And thanks so much, everyone, and remember to keep your eyes to the sky.